As our nation approaches 250 years of independence in its 57th presidential election, Community Conversations invites us to discuss the role democracy plays in our lives as members of local, national, and global communities. This morning, we partner with the New York Council for the Humanities and welcome two experts to have an in-depth discussion about civic participation and the meaning of democracy. We have two exceptional guests joining us in the studio this morning. Roger Berkowitz is associate professor in the departments of political studies, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, where he is academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities. James Cole is an adjunct associate professor of American and constitutional history at Nassau Community College and a detective with the New York City Police Department. In his work with the NYPD, James has received numerous awards, including being named Cop of the Year by the New York City Police Foundation for the efforts of his unit during the U.S. Airways Flight 1549 plane crash in the Hudson River in January 2009. It is a pleasure to welcome both of you to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let us begin with you, Roger, when we talk about democracy to kick off this conversation of where we begin with a definition of what that is.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and there's probably 4,000 definitions of democracy or more. We all know it comes from demos, the people, and rule, krasi, from the Greek, democracy. I think that one way to think of it this way is that a lot of people see democracy as about freedom. It's self-rule. And other people see democracy as about equality, about everyone has the same vote, everyone has the same rule. And democracy is really an attempt to create a government of freedom and equality. And the problem is that freedom and equality often mean very different things. And more equality sometimes means less freedom, and more freedom means less equality. And that's the productive tension of democracy.
When we talk about all of these various tenets, whether it be government by the people, rule of the majority, a government in which the supreme power is vested in the people, are these all working at times against each other instead of in concert with one another?
Well, I think it can be both. We talk about rule of the people, and we want people to participate, and that can lead to more equality insofar as more and more people participate, they're going to demand their interests be served. And yet as more and more people demand that their interests be served, people who've had a certain amount and have certain other freedoms are going to have those freedoms limited. And democracy is not an answer. It's a question in many ways, and that's, I think, very democratic in our understanding of democracy.
And James, when it comes to that definition question,
I think Roger makes a really good point. I mean, the part of the story, historically speaking, of American history is this march of democracy. More and more groups or more and more individuals that have been excluded from the franchise of voting or participation in democracy have been included over the course of American history. And that's a really important part of the story of our nation.
When it comes to that march, though, we're not there yet. I mean, can we all agree on that? I don't think we do agree on that, but at least in this room.
we're not there yet, as in there's certain people or certain groups that still can't vote?
Yes.
Well, children can't vote, and there are certainly people who think younger people should vote. I mean, we've had the question of 21 to 18, and I think as children become more and more savvy, especially with technology, there may be arguments to lower that age. There are people who would argue that we've had the Citizens United case. Should corporations or unions have a place at the table? Unions and corporations are both corporate citizens. And there are, we talk about corporate citizenship sometimes and that they should be good corporate citizens. And there have been people who've argued that in certain ways there should be representative for those kind of groups. And then, of course, there's the people who think robots will someday be able to vote. But that's a different question. I mean, Currently, what groups are excluded from voting that you're referring to?
Well, I just mean there are, we find that there are groups of people who perhaps we do not get out to vote. Perhaps there are swaths of the population that whose vote is not counted for one reason or another. And when we think of a true democracy, and I mean, we heard this in a phone call that we had less than an hour ago from an individual who said, there's people who have more skin in the game and they should have more of an opportunity to vote than others should. So, I mean, that is out there.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a theory of American democracy for a long time, that people will vote and be motivated to vote when they feel their issues are threatened or when there's really something at stake. And there have been many people who've argued that that's a good thing, that in a sense, the people who are more motivated to vote should be the ones voting because they're the ones for whom the issues matter more. The only countries that I know of where you have 100% voting were totalitarian countries. But you can't force people to vote. And I don't think you should.
Or want to.
I think some of this issue, when it comes to voting, we try and lay a lot of the blame at the doorstep of Washington, D.C., when, in fact, when we look at the constitutional structure, a lot of the blame or fault or praise, really falls in state governments. The Constitution explicitly provides a number of provisions where the states are deciding who the electorate are. Certainly when it comes to the Electoral College, there's not even a mention in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, that outlines the Electoral College. I know that's a big topic, obviously, with the events taking place tomorrow and the early voting issues. There's no provision at all in the Constitution that says that the people get a say in the election of the president. It says that the states, in 8 references in that clause of the Constitution, are empowered to decide how they allocate their electoral votes. What our state decides to do in New York is that they say whoever wins best another candidate wins the entire Electoral College vote. 48 states have that system. If that disenfranchises people, you're looking at a large segment of the population that is not represented in that Electoral College vote. So a number of the calls that you mentioned in the last program had mentioned about going to a direct popular vote. Would that enfranchise people? Well, it would certainly give a tremendous amount of weight to states like New York or large cities, but you wouldn't have candidates talking to dairy farmers in Iowa. You wouldn't have candidates talking to coal miners in Pennsylvania. They wouldn't be talking to students in Colorado. They wouldn't be talking to retirees in Florida. They'd be appealing their entire message to cities that have more than 40,000 people in their population.
Or would they be talking to every individual because every vote would count? So let me throw out the scenario that is a very possible scenario that comes out of tomorrow's voting, which is you have one candidate who does not win the popular vote but does win the Electoral College vote. Is that democratic? Is that democracy? Is that a rule of the majority?
Well, we don't live in necessarily just in a democracy. We live in a representative democracy, whereby on many issues, large and small, we elect other people to make decisions. Our Congress, who are representatives, they're empowered to decide issues like war, to make treaties. But essentially, the Electoral College is almost the same system, where we in our state are empowering 29 people to decide where our electoral votes will go. While we tend to think that this is not the most democratic system, as it is not, because it is not direct democracy, it is kind of in keeping with the principle of representative democracy, which is more along the lines of the basis of how the Constitution was founded. Keep in mind, out of the 3 branches of government, in the original drafting of the Constitution, as it's ratified in 1787, only one half of one branch of that 3-branch government is directly elected by the people, and that's the House of Representatives. All the other branches are elected or nominated by someone else that had some type of conduit between the people and the representative. So the Electoral College is not completely out of step with the historical trajectory of how our representative democracy has been cast.
Your thoughts, Roger Berkowitz?
The Electoral College was an important compromise in the history of the United States, and as Jim just said, it does force the candidates to speak to to people not in the big cities. You ask, would a one vote, one system majority rule lead to everyone being talked to? Probably not. The amount of money that would take in this day and age is, well, there's so much money in the system now, it would boggle the mind. But
we'd all get to see the cool ads.
Well, that's, Jim and I were talking about this in the green room. And he was saying, well, it would be great if New York went to a system in which, we apportioned our electoral votes by congressional district. And my cynical reaction was absolutely not, because then I'd have to watch all the political ads. There's a certain irrelevance that we have in New York in the presidential election right now, because we're not at play. On the other hand, we get to go on with our daily lives and not have to worry about it, which is exactly the opposite of what democracy should be. The problem is that what democracy has become is that actually participating in government means listening to 80 days of ads in a row.
And those 80 days of ads, I agree with you, Jim, of what you say about that we wouldn't have the candidates talking to the dairy farmers in Iowa, and we wouldn't have these discussions taking place in Ohio. But are we having those discussions that are taking place in Clinton County of New York as well in Berkshire County in Massachusetts and in Litchfield County in Connecticut? Or are those just put aside because all of our focus is in this? I was watching 60 Minutes last night, and the great historian David McCullough was on, and he said to Morley Safer, he said, look, the disgusting amount of money that is being spent on advertising in this campaign, gobs and gobs and gobs of money, what has that bought us? Has that improved the show? Has that improved the level of discourse? Has that improved the conversation? And it seems that it hasn't. So how do we do that and bring these things to light and still improve democracy?
Well, part of the issue when it comes to people spending, as you said, gobs and gobs of money. I would actually say gobs and gobs and gobs of money.
Absolutely.
You're talking about a tremendous amount of money. You have a free speech component there as well that weighs in on this, an individual deciding how they want to allocate their money. And the Supreme Court has been wrestling with this with cases like Citizens United. So there is this other component when it comes to spending money. Money equals speech, whether it's an individual or a corporation or a union. I think one of the larger issues is that we've tend to move away from. The reason why Clinton County is being ignored, the reason why Hamilton County, the reason why Kings County is being ignored, with 2.3 million people in Brooklyn, and we're more concerned about one congressional district in the state of Nebraska that only has 1.84 million people in it. Why? Because of the system that they have, where they allocate electoral votes in Nebraska, as in Maine, based upon congressional districts. And President Obama, when he was then candidate Obama, on election day in November of 2008, won a single electoral district in the state of Nebraska. And both candidates up until June of this year had already spent $827,000 to win the second congressional district in the state of Nebraska. Why? Because it looks like it's going to be a really, really close electoral college decision tomorrow. So what would that do to our state? Now, for us to go to a popular vote, we'd have to change the Constitution. Mm. And it may not be a surprise, but Wyoming, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Dakota, Delaware, Maryland, they're not going to change the system. And you need 3/4 of the states to agree to that. So let's look at what we could do in our state. I've gone on, I've spoke at dozens of conversations and speakers events with the New York Council for Humanities around the state over the past few weeks and months about the issue of electing the president. And you start to see people say that this system is not fair. The way that we allocate our votes, we could change it, not through a constitutional amendment at the federal level, which is really hard to do, but at a law, with a law passed in New York State tomorrow if they wanted to. Keep this in mind. If we went to a congressional district-based electoral vote allocation, we could have competition over our electoral votes in a way that they're not doing today. Sure, the candidates come to our state, but they come here to raise money and then bring it somewhere else. If we went to a different system that our state legislature could decide tomorrow, what that would force the candidates to do is be competitive in our state. So they're spending $127,000 for a single congressional district in Nebraska. You know, John McCain in 2008 won four congressional districts in New York. What do you think they would spend for four electoral votes in our state? Mm. Force our state to be competitive. Why Republicans up in Albany are not speaking about this, especially this year, is beyond me. Doesn't make any sense. We could be relevant.
Roger?
I mean, I think Jim is absolutely right that we could be relevant. I don't think this is the main problem. I mean, I'm not someone who thinks that the question of the Electoral College or, you know, whether we should split up the Electoral College, I'm not opposed to it. I don't think it's the issue. What it will bring is more money into the elections nationally and in New York, and it will keep the question on getting one of two parties elected in a system that, the reason most people don't really complain too much about not having much say in who's elected in New York is because most people realize it doesn't, you know, yes, it matters. There are interests that will be served. I don't want to say the president and who wins doesn't matter. There will be definitely decisions, but it's not going to change things on a large level in the country. And I think most people see that the government has gotten so bureaucratic and so big and so alien from the ability of anyone, including a president, to actually transform it in a meaningful way, that they don't complain too much about being left out of the system. In fact, they sort of like it. They don't have to watch all the TV ads.
We are talking about democracy this morning. It's a community conversation on democracy presented in a partnership with the New York Council for the Humanities. You can find out more information about their great work at nyhumanities.org, nyhumanities.org. Roger Berkowitz is associate professor in the Departments of Political Studies, Philosophy, and Human Rights at Bard College. Jim Cole is an adjunct associate professor of American and Constitutional History at Nassau Community College and a detective with the New York City Police Department. We will continue our conversation and include your phone calls. You can get in early, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We'll continue this conversation and include your phone calls after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. We're having a community conversation on democracy this morning, presented in partnership with the New York Council for the Humanities, and you can find out more information about their great work at nyhumanities.org. Just before we go to the phone calls, and we welcome your phone calls on the subject of democracy, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-34-TALK-1. Typically how these community conversations work and the program that the council has put forth is, look, they're trying to promote thoughtful and engaged community dialogue, and they all have a text and then a facilitator, and then the local community will get together and discuss these issues. And you've both been part of, have these in one form or another, and I assume they get quite passionate.
Yeah, they do tend to get quite passionate, but what the New York Council tries to do is they try to bring us into a community and try and have nonpartisan discussions, which it may be kind of difficult for people to separate themselves from the passion that they feel about these issues or these candidates or politics in general. And the idea is to take members of a community and have them have discussions beyond just bumper sticker conversations, and maybe be able to see across the aisle and say, hey, I may not agree with you, but what you're saying makes sense. And what it's come down to a lot when it talks about politics on both political parties, it's kind of the demonization of the other side. And there, if the other person is elected, we're going to fall off a cliff. And what I try and do in my conversations, and I know what the community council tries to do, New York Council tries to do, is try and have these nonpartisan, where we can have conversations that are at a little bit of a higher level.
We do welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these conversations are very important for a number of reasons. Alexis de Tocqueville said in his book, Democracy in America, that the experience of being a juror spreads to all classes respect for the thing judged, namely right and wrong. And it's important. Being on a jury, it teaches you have to make a decision. Was this person guilty or not? And you think about it. And you think, well, where do we do that in politics? Where do we have the experience in our lives where we have to put aside our life for, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, a week, a month, and ask, you know, what's right, what's wrong? You know, we vote how long does that take? You know, I mean, and even that, you know, I remember the experience of waiting on a line and voting, and you would be there with people and you felt like you were in a civic, you know, thing. Today, you can do it online, you can do it on an absentee ballot. In fact, we want people to have less and less interruption of their life to vote.
Right.
And these community conversations, you know, are important. And they're not just the community conversations, but where you get a group of citizens together in a room and you talk about things and you let disagreements, and they're not all Democrats or all Republicans or all wealthy or all poor, and you let people, or all white or all black or anything, and you let people just talk about, you know, John Dewey or Hannah Arendt or Alexis de Tocqueville, and it brings up all sorts of conversations, and it does create the kind of political discourse that is the kind of school that a juries can be about right and wrong in the world of politics. And we need more of such things in all sorts of forms.
If anyone is interested in organizing or finding out how to facilitate such a conversation in your community, you can find out more information about the New York Council for the Humanities and their Community Conversations program by going to nyhumanities.org. nyhumanities.org, and we will give that information at the end of the segment. A reminder, Roger Berkowitz is with us, associate professor in the departments of political studies, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. Jim Cole is also with us, an adjunct associate professor of American and constitutional history at Nassau Community College and a detective with the New York City Police Department. We do welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK1. Lines are loaded, and we begin with Carl in Palatine. Carl, good morning.
Hi. I've never heard, I shouldn't say in the last year, I haven't heard Joe so enthusiastic as he was, is today, this morning.
Well, I try to be enthusiastic every day, but this issue certainly gets me enthusiastic when we talk about democracy.
This one clearly has your wheels rolling.
Yes.
I had a couple of brief points just to make and to ask to your responses, to listen to your responses. One is, the word democracy, I think, gets diluted and misused. We all prefer to call ourselves a democracy, which is fine, a representative democracy, technically more accurate. But we forget that our country was formed as a republic. And I sometimes confuse myself in trying to remember the distinctions, historically speaking at least, between republic and democracy. I think back to the Athenian democracy. Well, this wasn't the rule of the majority. There was a very select group that ran and governed later on in the period that was called the Roman Republic, a comparatively brief period within the time, within the centuries of the Roman Empire. This was also ruled by councils, by senators, and this carried over to our system. I will shut up.
Well, let us talk about that when we talk about democracy and republic.
That's an excellent question. We are, you know, we can call ourselves a democracy, a representative democracy. We're really a constitutional federal republic with a democratic form of republican democracy. You know, and the republican form was imagined by James Madison as an important corrective on one of the great dangers of democracy, namely that the tyranny of the majority. And the idea was that a large republic, you could never get rid of factions, Madison said. You're always going to have people with factions, and factions are going to be like fuel on fire. But if you have a large republic, there'll be one faction for this side and one faction on that side and many other factions, and they'll sort of balance themselves out. And in many ways, the large republican federal style of government from the founders' point of view was an attempt to deal with the ills of democracy. And so this is one of the, and the Electoral College was one element of that, as were state, federal, local, and different power structures in government. And so in many ways, our constitutional system, and a constitution itself is a limit on democracy. It's here's what the people can't do unless they amend the constitution. So our system was set up to protect against what the founders understood were to be real ills of democracy, while at the same time providing as much public input, participation, and freedom in self-government as one could have. And that's a very delicate balance. And yet, and it's important, therefore, to remember. And it's that we are a Republican federal constitutional democracy. And I think it's important to keep all those in mind.
And when we talk about this whole thing, Jim, it's all a delicate balance, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's absolutely a delicate balance. I mean, what you see out of this is throughout the 20th century, we've seen more and more, while we've seen a march to democracy, we've seen a march towards the federal government doing more and more. And that may be good on some levels, and it may be bad on other levels. Roger brings up a really good point to Carl's point about us being a republic. One of the limitations of having such a one of the limitations that Madison envisioned to having such a large democracy spread out over a large republic spread out over such a large area is that the federal constitution would be limited, would be a limitation on power, as Roger pointed out. And we've moved away from that largely. More and more power being centered in Washington. And this is not Republican or Democratic speaking. I mean, just historically speaking, the role of the federal government was designed to be limited. Article 1, Section 8 basically talks about what the Congress is empowered to do, not what we think it should do. So there is this trajectory that the balance is not necessarily, or maybe it is necessarily, that's part of the discussion as well, what the founders envisioned for the federal government to be doing.
Carl, thank you very much for the phone call. That frees up a line for you, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Simon in upstate New York. Simon, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A few things. I mean, I think that I wonder how well these discussions go, and I presume that they go well, but, you know, they're not happening at the gas station. They're not happening at the diner. They're not happening with your neighbors. And so
they could
absolutely, but I'm just pointing out, and they should, and hopefully they will with more frequency into the future. But I worry about our democracy for the next 4 years, no matter who is elected president. And I matter because those conversations have broken down. And I wonder what you guys think is the solution to ending a horrifically gridlocked Congress, which seems far more interested in anything except for the issues of the day. And so I'm wondering how these conversations bring us closer to that and how we ultimately hold our representatives accountable for the things, really, that they don't do.
Great question.
I think we are having these conversations, maybe not at the water cooler or maybe not at the gas station, but we are having these conversations in the New York Council for the Humanities. And this is why we're getting invited to speak to community groups. This is why we encourage us speaking at libraries and other places around the state so that, Simon, we can have these conversations. I think that the other answer to this is the fact that we've come to expect far too little from our politicians. When they represent just the interests of the party, what we've done is we've empowered them to act in the interests of their party. So with a 98% reelection rate in Congress, yet a 9% approval rating for the institution itself, we've empowered people to not listen to us anymore. When it comes to the list of what politicians think are important, for the most part, the first thing that's important, even ahead of themselves, is their party. This is just not the way that the founders envisioned government to be taking place. They talked about things like virtue, things like character, things like, you know, these virtuous and virtuous people going to places to be the representatives of the people in a government like this.
So, Roger, when it comes to Simon's concern about the next 4 years of no matter who gets elected tomorrow, presidentially speaking, what does that do? Because his point is absolutely correct. We have such a gridlock. We have such partisanship. How do we bust that apart? And can we do that through just conversations?
Well, I mean, just conversations. Conversations are on the one hand, toothless. On the other hand, that's really what we have in a democracy. I think that just conversations cease to be just conversations when they become about things that we care about and that matter to us.
But are they listening?
Well, I mean, and then who's the they? I mean, if we really were to engage, I mean, if people were to... I mean, you have to ask yourself, why is it that we're not having the conversations? Why is it that people aren't listening? And one reason is, and I've said this a little bit before, I don't think people care that much. People go on with their lives. They're more. We live at a time in which people see most of what concerns them having to do with their private life, and not with the government. The government seems to many people quite foreign. And when it matters, it seems like a huge bureaucracy that is that is almost unchangeable. And so I think people feel quite hopeless and helpless in the idea of changing democracy. Gridlock is one huge manifestation of that. And yet for many people, and this has been said many times, gridlock is positive. It sort of keeps the status quo where it is, which they're very happy with.
1-800-348-2551 is a telephone number. We go to Doug in Albany. Doug, good morning.
Good morning. This is a very interesting conversation we're having there. First of all, I want to let you know that I've been I'm a very partisan individual. I've been a committeeman for approximately since 1980. Been a civil servant for 29 years. I was born in abject poverty, and I could be considered a tanker. Okay, and then I was on welfare when I was a child. Okay, unfortunately, I was able to get a scholarship to a prep school in Connecticut, which I graduated. Graduated from college, went on to get a master's degree locally here in the capital region. So I'm a taker. However, since then, I've chaired no more than 8 or 10 not-for-profit boards, and I feel a profound responsibility to give back for what I've been given. And I said, in this democracy, the partisans on the other side of the aisle, which would be the right wing, have a systematic plan in which they want to, and they have taken over our government by installing judges, not only at the local level, at the federal level, which have given us a Citizen United decision, which now says that corporations are citizens, and we have gone from a democracy to we've been totally taken over by economic interests, and so that the interests of the rich are usurping the interests of the individual people, and that this is something that is worth being partisan about. And I think if we're going to save our democracy, we have to ensure that each individual citizen has a equal voice.
How do we do that?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, first of all, Doug, I mean, it's an inspiring story and one that as a teacher, one hopes to hear. I mean, Bard does a lot of this work in prison programs around the city and the state. You know, we're involved in a lawsuit right now that I was just telling Joe about at the break, where, you know, and it's a question of how to frame this, partisan or not. In Red Hook, where Bard is, the county has over a number of years tried to prevent Bard students to vote in the area. And it's been a constant battle to get them allowed to vote, which, according to state law, students living for more than 9 months in an area or a certain amount of months can vote. And currently, there will be a decision today by a court whether a number of students at Bard, the Marist, and the Culinary Institute will be able to vote in the area. And the question is, well, why are they stopping it? Well, it's because the perception is that students are Democrats, and so there's a lot of ensconced interests that want to stop them. Is that partisan? Yes, in some way, but you know, it would go. Trust me, it goes the other way on the other side. Politics is in the end about a number of things, but one thing it's about is interests. It's about people pursuing their interests, and we shouldn't be surprised when people do that. That said, when all that politics becomes about is pursuing interests, and we lose the idea that politics is also about building a world together and believing that we are part of a res publica, a republic, which is a public thing, that which we share, well, then we lose. Then it just becomes all about interest and it's all about power, and we lose the very possibility of a meaningful life together in a political world.
And if we sour people on democracy very early in their voting life,
yeah,
and maybe the first or second time that they've ever voted, that especially seems
incredibly problematic. And you see these students. I mean, we've been there at the voting booths, and the students are being prohibited from casting their vote when they've been registered, and they get angry and they get upset. And they get discouraged, and as they should, and they get discouraged, and it's the wrong message to send. I mean, you know. It is the young people. There's a lot of studies out there that show that your first, you know, that voting early makes you a voter for life. You discourage people from voting in college, you're going to discourage people from voting later on.
Well, we have, you talk about voter participation, we have in our state, I mean, I hate to keep harping on this, but we have in our state, like, legally sanctioned voter disenfranchisement. In 2008, Barack Obama garnered 63% of the popular vote in the state of New York. That meant that 37% of the popular vote went to another candidate or other candidates. Yet 100% of the electoral vote in our state went to the Obama-Biden campaign. And that may be fine if you're a Democrat in New York, but that's not fine if you're a Democrat in Texas. So there are issues here, and this is now, we're not talking about, you know, groups of people disenfranchising people. We're talking about legally sanctioned voter disenfranchisement. That could be addressed very, very easily.
Not to mention prisoners.
Not to mention,
and former prisoners.
That
even.
Situation as well.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones and go to Caroline and Sharon. Caroline, good morning.
Hello. Some of the last comments really feed right into what I was thinking about, and that is, if we're concerned that not enough people are concerned enough to vote, the fact that these states have winner-take-all really discourages it. As was just said, a Republican in New York State or a Democrat in Mississippi, If they really thought about it, it would be important to vote because of some of the down ticket elections. But if it's a presidential election and they know that their vote is not going to count, then it's a problem. And I think probably, as was said before, the easiest way to change this would be to go to this proportional representation by district. Because then a Republican in New York in a certain district might be able to get some electoral votes for his or her candidate. So I think that would be something really worth working for, and it would probably increase the number, the percentage of people that vote in the country as a whole.
I mean, this is a great point. I mean, the fact that people are being disenfranchised, or the fact that candidates are ignoring our state, is something that absolutely should be addressed. We actually have the opportunity to do this. In 2017, every 20 years, mandated in our New York State Constitution, we have the idea that the people of New York can vote by proposition, mandated again by the Constitution, whether or not we will have a constitutional convention in our state.
Right.
So we can kind of go around the politicians, Republican and Democrat, in our state, and decide whether we would go to a proportional vote that Caroline was talking about, or go to a congressional district vote, or keep the system that we have. But the fact that voters and the citizens of New York need to know that in 2017, 5 years from this November, there will be on the ballot the idea of having a constitutional convention to change this and other things in our state that may affect the idea that voters do not have the opportunity to have a say in government. In 1997, the last time this was on the ballot, 15 years ago, just under 1 million people said yes, we should have a constitutional convention. Just under 1.5 million people said no. But most alarmingly to me, and what should be most alarmingly to many New Yorkers, is the fact that just over 1.6 million people that came out to vote in that particular election in New York never even answered the question. So the fact that we, as citizens, like many of your calls talking about participation,
right,
we as citizens have the opportunity to do this ourselves if our politicians fail to address the issues.
We're going to wrap up our conversation by going to a call, which I think really picks up where you left off, Jim. Troy is in Albany. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I think your point is very interesting of how do you connect people to the process?
It's really amazing to me, especially after the storm that we just had. I see people talking about how they do or don't want big government, and it's an awful thing, and then they start working with FEMA because they were affected in the storm, not realizing that that is a federal and not a state government. How to know what is a local, not even knowing what's local, what's federal, what's state. How do we, it used to be when I was a kid, you know, people from the city, kids from the city didn't know where milk came from. It comes from the store because they'd never seen a cow.
Right.
So how do we get the cow? How do we get government as it is currently formatted to be something? How do we get people to see that it is something local, and how is it connected to federal. How do we do that?
We only have about a minute and a half, but I'll let you both take a bat at that one. Troy, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. I mean, and there are a number of different ways to bring power to the people in a way that makes them think it's important enough to get involved. One of you had a guest on right before we came on talking about these meetings where people would come in and help discuss study groups. There are also places where some city governments and state governments are now setting aside some money that will be apportioned based on citizen participation. Getting citizens, once there's money involved, citizens are going to come and they're going to start talking about it. And getting citizens more involved at a lower level, local level politics, I think is the first step to getting people back into the political process.
Jim?
I agree. I think we kind of have to deal with the demon that we have right now, and that's the fact that money has infiltrated politics. Influence has been infiltrated by money. So what do we do? I mean, it's very hard to change the system at the national level, so we have to, you know, think nationally and act locally. Start electing candidates that are talking this way and thinking about us instead of their party. And I think that that's the key to, you know, taking back the government in our state.
Jim Cole is an adjunct associate professor of American and constitutional history at Nassau Community College and a detective with the New York City Police Department. Jim, thank you very much for
being with us.
Roger Berkowitz is associate professor in the departments of political studies, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, where he is academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities. Roger, thank you.
Thank you.
A great pleasure to have you both here. This community conversation on democracy was presented in partnership with the New York Council for the Humanities. To find out more information about community conversations and how you can hold one in your community and discuss these very issues, just go to their website, nyhumanities.org, nyhumanities.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.